The Gospels as Literary Works by Robert C. Newman. Brief abstract. A consideration of the New Testament Gospels from the perspective of how they function as literature. To what genre do the Gospels belong? What techniques are employed by the Gospel writers to connect most strongly with their readers? When we think about the Gospels as literary works, we're not thinking of them as being written to make money, as many literary works are written today, or that they're written mainly to show off someone's artistic abilities, as many literary works are today, but we're thinking of the fact that literature is designed to communicate, if you like. So one of the persons who's done the perhaps the most work among evangelicals, at least in this area, is Leland Ryken. He originally wrote a work called Words of Life, a literary introduction to the New Testament. Here we see a picture of the paperback edition of that. And then later expanded that to Words of Delight, a literary introduction to the Bible, which covers both the Old and the New Testaments. He was also the main mover and shaker, if you like, and one of the three editors of the Dictionary of Biblical Imagery, published by InterVarsity. That you can see here, cover of it as well, which has many, many excellent articles on how biblical imagery is used, how imagery is used in the Bible, if you like. Well, we want to start out thinking about the literary form of the gospel narratives. What kind of writings are the gospels? What is the overall genre of the gospels, we might ask it. Several suggestions have been made. We'll look at each of these in turn and say a few things about it. Are they biography? Are they propaganda? Are they dramatic history? Are they collections of stories? Well, let's see. The genre biography, what about it? Well, obviously the Gospels are presenting information about Jesus, and biographies present information about a particular character who is their subject. And Jesus actually lived in history. We don't usually call something a biography if it's fictional. So the Gospels are obviously biographical in some sense. However, the term biography is frequently used in a more specialized sense, like biography in the modern scholarly sense. So-and-so has written the definitive biography on so-and-so, on a particular person. Well, the Gospels are not biography in the modern scholarly sense, in that they are not by an uninvolved, detached observer. The writers of the Gospels believed that Jesus was who he claimed to be, that he was a God who had manifested himself in history by taking on human nature, etc. They're not biography in a modern scholarly sense, in the sense of giving all important dates and facts about Jesus. Luke gives us some dates, if you like, in the standard way that would be given in the Roman world of his time. But the Gospels tell us very little about Jesus' early years. Basically, we have two birth narratives, and then a little bit in Luke about an incident that happened to Jesus around age 12, and then nothing more until the Gospels pick up with his beginning of his public ministry when he is around 30. So they don't give all the important dates and facts. And they're not biography in the modern scholarly sense, in that they're not primarily personal reminiscences. Look, I was with him and I remember this and this about so-and-so. This was a rather characteristic feature of even ancient biographies, as we'll see in a minute. And modern scholarly biographers would certainly attempt to interview people and get their personal reminiscences about so-and-so. Nor are the Gospels primarily character studies. They do give us insight into the character of Jesus, but because of who Jesus is, that's a tricky sort of thing. And yet they're not personal reminiscences in the sense that the authors do not make any big deal of themselves. It's possible that Mark puts in a little vignette about himself with the young man who does in fact lose his outer garment when Jesus is arrested and such. But And perhaps Matthew gives us a little touch when he alone, of all the gospel writers, speaks of Matthew as the tax collector in one of the gospel lists. However, the Gospels are more like biography in the ancient popular sense. There were a number of biographies written in ancient times. And here, like in these ancient biographies, the author has practical concerns. The author wants to edify his readers in not a merely scholarly way. He wants them to admire the particular person or see what flaw that particular person has or something of that sort. The ancient popular biographies were trying to acquaint the reader with a historical person, and the Gospels are certainly trying to do that. And they did this by giving an account of the deeds and words of this particular ancient person, and the Gospels are certainly doing that with Jesus, etc. In fact, the Gospels resemble ancient biographies about Socrates or Epictetus, another philosopher, or Apollonius, miracle worker, teacher, etc. But the Gospels concentrate on Jesus' death. If you think about it, nearly half of the Gospel of John centers in on the events in just the last week up to Jesus' death, and smaller but very big fractions of Mark, and then less of Luke and Matthew concentrate on the last week. But all of them, it's a big, big piece of those Gospels. And as I said, virtually nothing about Jesus' childhood and such. And they concentrate on reactions to him. The people who gave up everything to follow him, the people who opposed him and pursued him until they could put him to death, etc. So the Gospels concentrate on Jesus' death and on reactions to him. Well, that's the genre biography, and I think it's fair to say that the Gospels belong to that with certain qualifications. What about the genre propaganda? This type of writing is also popularly called PR, public relations, sales pitch, hype, etc. Well, the Gospels are trying to convince readers that Jesus is vitally important and move them to respond to him. But propaganda, at least it is commonly used in English, seeks to propagate ideas or attitudes. Well, there's some of that going on in the Gospels. But also is a dirty word today, because it usually involves playing fast and loose with the truth, emphasizing the good points about the person, if it's a person you're trying to get him to, get your reader to respond positively to, or dumping on the person if you're trying to get the person to respond negatively to them, etc. And sometimes it's sloppy in those areas. And propaganda often works on our fears and prejudices and tries to excite our emotions, etc. And we don't see that in the Gospels. The Gospel writers are inviting a reader response, but they're not writing a story just to spark people's interest or fire their imagination, although the stories about Jesus have often done that. They're rather seeking to invite the readers to trust in Jesus, to put their faith in Jesus. And we see then from the, as they're coupled with the apostolic writings of the Paul's letters and such, that they want us to realize that Jesus is who he claimed to be, and that we need to depend upon his atoning death in order to have forgiveness with God. The Gospel writers are, in fact, surprising, if you're trying to put the Gospels in the genre of propaganda, and that's because they restrain their post-Easter faith in telling the story. They typically do not themselves introduce their own opinions and make a big deal. Now, we're telling you about how the second person of the Trinity came to earth and took upon himself a human nature and things of that sort. That's not the way they word their presentation. They restrain their post-Easter faith in telling the story. They're trying to give you a feeling for what it was like to actually encounter this Jesus before the disciples realized who he was and before the disciples realized that he was going to die a terrible death and be raised from the dead. they let the events tell their own story rather than intruding their own opinions into the matter. So, yes, there's a sense in which the Gospels are propaganda, but not in that sense of hype and PR and that sort of thing, but in fact in the sense of seeking to get people to respond properly to Jesus. Third suggested category is dramatic history. The Gospels, dramatic history. Well, the Gospels are certainly telling a dramatic story of the person, actions, impact of Jesus, a real figure in history. So dramatic on one side and history on the other side. And they do in some ways look more like plays than they do like modern narratives. That's part of what's going on in dramatic history and why you get the term dramatic. Dramatic, after all, comes from drama, and drama from reference to, in ancient times, to acted plays on the stage, and then in more recent times, to characters acting in a movie or something of that sort. Huh? They do look, in some ways, more like plays than modern narratives. Roland Fry, a literary specialist at University of Pennsylvania, thinks the Gospels should be classed as dramatic histories like those of Shakespeare and George Bernard Shaw, and he works through some examples from both of these, which I will not do. But he basically points out that dramatic history is characterized this way. It's an essentially a fair representation of events. It's not biased, etc. Fry himself does not, as far as I know, hold the inspiration of Scripture, but essentially fair includes the categories completely fair and such as well. Essentially fair representation of events. It's directed toward a broad general audience, and certainly that is the intention of the Gospels. John explicitly says it's intended that this might produce faith in the reader, so it does not imply the reader is just going to be a believer already. The dramatic histories, such as Shakespeare and Shaw wrote, are condensed to hold one's attention. That's the result of the Gospels as well, and it'd be perhaps hard for us to get a feel to what extent the Gospels are condensed over against other works of the time. They're certainly short by modern standards. They would be more what we would think of as short stories or something of that sort. But they're short by ancient standards as well. Josephus writes his Antiquities of the Jews in 20 books, which would be roughly 20 times the length of the Gospel, and his Jewish War in 7 books, roughly 7 times the length of the Gospels, and some of the Roman histories were ran up to around 40 books or so. So these were short, and I think part of the reason for the condensing is to hold attention. Part of it probably is to make them something that people could afford. After all, in antiquity, without printing presses, books were copied by hand, and ability to write a readable handwriting style and consistent so it looks decent was a fairly valuable skill, and so you're getting skilled labor for the length of time it takes to write something like that. They were expensive in antiquity. The characteristics of dramatic history: essentially fair representation of events, directed to a broad general audience, condensed, hold attention. And then how do you do this condensation? Use representative people, incidents, actions to give an accurate picture while keeping the length down. And what I mean by representative there is sample people. Give a sample of an opponent, if you like, sample of a person healed, a sample of a reaction by a military person, by a hated tax collector, by a harlot, etc. So that's basically the picture here that we have. So, yes, it's fair to say that the Gospels fit under the category of dramatic history, in fact, rather well. Collections of stories was a fourth suggestion for the genre of Gospels. In contrast to modern biographies, the Gospels are most striking in being a collection of stories. Not only are they dramatic, a little bit like plays are, but they almost look like a series of stories strung like beads on a string or something. That's a little exaggerated, but we basically see a sequence of incidents in which Jesus is involved, some speeches that he gives, some brief sayings that he gives, etc., and they look like a collection of some sort. The Gospels are action-packed, as perhaps little short stories would be, anecdotes would be, and numerous brief stories allow more of the action packing, if you like, than a connected narrative would. This collection of stories centers on Jesus, on who he is, and what he did, person and work, and they explain Jesus, that is, you have him saying things about himself, and you have him doing things that illustrate this, and they celebrate Jesus, not so much in the sense that the author is giving evaluative comments, but you're getting some of that in the evaluative comments of the audience reaction at the time Jesus does and says these particular things. These stories use narrative to show Jesus' actions, to show his words, and to show responses of others to him. The Gospels look like a collection of stories as well in containing varied materials. We think they were probably used independently before compilation, although that's been taken in drastic directions by some of the more liberal New Testament scholars, the idea that these floated around for a couple generations before they were written down. I don't think they floated around at all in regard to the authorship of the Gospels, as the Gospels were written by two apostles and by two immediate associates, but that the apostles and their associates and others used these anecdotes in different circumstances and then pulled them together in a compilation when the time of the Gospel writing took place. They probably were used then independently before being compiled. And as a result, there are varied categories of narratives as well. Sometimes events are only sketched, sometimes they're detailed. Sometimes we get a dialogue between two persons, or sometimes we basically get a statement that so-and-so come up to Jesus and ask him a question, and then basically you get a monologue about Jesus, if you like. We get, in fact, a good deal of the words of Jesus, sometimes just brief sayings in context of controversy or responding to questions or something of that sort, and sometimes extended discourses, such as the Sermon on the Mount or the Upper Room Discourse in John. And then you also get the words of Jesus in these peculiar things we call parables, which were in use and by the rabbis at Jesus' time. The striking thing about Jesus was the extensive use he made of them and the fact that at least a fair number of them were not always explained. Well, a summary then on the genre of the Gospels. Most people have felt that the Gospels need to belong to a genre of their own, but they do resemble the genres we've suggested. The Gospels are like ancient popular biography. They are seeking to propagate faith, though they avoid the pitfalls of propaganda in general. They are like dramatic histories of Shakespeare, George Bernard Shaw, and they are, in fact, collections of stories, though there's more to it than that. The connections are not totally missing. We move on then to a related question regarding the Gospels as literary works, their techniques. What techniques are used by the Gospel writers? How do the Gospels carry out their mission of communicating Jesus to the readers? Well, we suggest these Gospel techniques: restraint and objectivity, concise, compressed accounts, very concrete narration, selection of materials, variety, sampling. Let's look at the first of these, restraint and objectivity. The Gospels are unusual in this regard, even compared to ancient biographies. The authors let Jesus speak and act. The narrator does not hog the activity by spending a lot of time in the narrative discussion. In other words, you don't have the narrator doing most of the talking. The authors do not try to persuade or to influence the reader by evaluative comments. Jesus was really compassionate when he did this. Jesus did some amazing miracles, etc. Don't see much of that. The only technique that the narrators use in seeking to persuade or influence, if you like, is selection. What incidents do they select? How much space do they give to them, etc.? Concise and compressed, second category here, especially in the synoptics. Most of the incidents are what we might call concise and compressed. Most of them are single scene with basically two actors, three occasionally, a group acting as a unit. The crowd said, you know, amazing, or the disciples said, who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him, etc. So two actors, group acting as a unit. The incidents are told with very economical use of words. What we see here, single scene, two actors, groups operating as units, told with very economical uses of words, etc., is a standard characteristic of storytelling. These stories might be true or they might not. We believe they're true in the Gospels. John doesn't do as much of this. He works with fewer accounts, but they're longer and more detailed, so not as much concision and compression, if you like, in order to develop the scenes more. Thirdly, concrete narration. When you condense something, there's a danger of getting into great generality and blandness. Now, one of the assignments I used to give my students in one of my courses was to write out their testimony in about three pages. That is, how they came to know the Lord, something like their spiritual background, etc. And then after they'd done that, I told them now to condense it into a one-page narration. And one could, in principle, then ask them also to condense it into one paragraph. Now, what usually happens when you do that is that the narration in three pages might be fairly concrete and vivid, if you like, but by the time you've got it down to one page or a paragraph, it's become very general. It's become rather bland, etc. I came to know Jesus when I was a teenager, etc. And to shorten it, it's become very general, very bland, etc. To avoid this, one uses concrete narration. What's that? Well, use a few specific incidents instead of a bunch of generalized incidents. In other words, as you're trying to shorten this thing, you don't have room for 10 incidents. You have to do it in two incidents or one incident, etc. You use short, vivid descriptions so as to handle that incident in just a few words, a little bit like an artist's sketch, which certain skilled artists can picture a person or even perhaps an individual person by just a few strokes of their writing instrument, etc. A concrete narration typically uses direct discourse. Instead of the narrator describing that so-and-so, Jesus spoke on the topic of the how one should live and contrasted it with the scribes and the Pharisees, etc., you pick out maybe only a selection of the things that Jesus said, but you actually give the words, and you use direct discourse. Jesus said, don't be like the scribes and the Pharisees, etc., and give an illustration of it, if you like. In concrete narration, we see a characterization of various people by their words or actions rather than by an author's description. Charles Dickens is one of the classic authors who will begin to describe someone by his own narration, and such. And the gospel writers don't do that. They do it typically by the words and actions. Now, Dickens is also good at that, and Dickens, of course, has got lots of room. He is not working on something so short as the gospels are. Another item on the technique is selection of materials. The author selects which event he's going to recount that will illustrate this or that feature about Jesus' person or work. He then selects how he's going to tell it. Who am I going to give half a page to this? Am I going to give just a sentence to this? That sort of thing. The author then communicates his emphasis to his reader, not by evaluation, wow, what Jesus did was really impressive that day, but by the space provided. So he zeroes in on the crucifixion for. Say, John zeroes in on that day in which, after Jesus had turned, had multiplied the loaves, the crowds catch up with him the next day, and he gives this discourse about eating my flesh and drinking my blood. So not by evaluation, but by the space provided. Sometimes by the expectations that are aroused. The atmosphere and the placement of a thing may help the reader to fill in the blanks, if you like, or see that this is something very central. I think perhaps of the way in which Mark uses this theme of the person of Jesus, starts out with the beginning of the gospel of Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God, etc. But then, through the leading up to the middle of this gospel, you have again and again somebody asking, who is this? Who is this that claims to, that, you know, forgive sins? But God alone can do that. Who is this that even the winds and sea obey him? And then you have kind of a climax in the middle of the gospel where Peter says, you're the Messiah, okay? And then the writer picks that up again where the centurion at the cross said, surely this one is the Son of God, etc. So the expectation of you begin to get these questions of who is this, and it begins to get you thinking about who is this. Well, we Christian readers who have read the Bible dozens of times, or at least heard the Sunday school stories dozens of times, we often have had our expectations dulled by that. But a person who comes on this for the first time and is looking will see these things, and they will arouse certain expectations. Another feature, another technique of the gospel writers is variety. The author groups material to provide variety. The author may alternate between incidents that emphasize Jesus' actions and other emphasis, other incidents that center around his words. He may alternate between events in which Jesus does something miraculous and events in which he is in controversy with the Pharisees, typically. Or he may alternate incidents in which Jesus is interacting with his followers versus incidents in which he's interacting with his opponents. So those would be examples of grouping material where you go back and forth, perhaps, or whether you group a few controversy incidents in this, what's now a chapter, and over in this one chapter, there are miracles or something of that sort. This technique helps to keep the attention of the audience. If you had miracle after miracle after miracle, which we understand from the gospel writers they could perfectly well have done, the attention of the person might eventually lag or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. A related phenomenon that relates to variety, if you like, is sampling. Rather than give a full report, the gospel writers give us samples of Jesus' speech, samples of Jesus' action. Various kinds of samples. If you go through the various gospels, you'll see that the gospel writers give us different types of miracles. A sample of a resurrection, a sample of a healing, a sample of an exorcism, a sample of a nature miracle of some sort. They give us Jesus' interaction with various kinds of people, with rich people, with poor people, with governmental-type people, with religious-type people, with military-type people, with respected people and with people who would be considered generally the scum of the earth. You get samples of the different kinds of opposition to Jesus as well. You get samples of Jesus' speeches on various occasions, speeches in which he gives us a whole series of parables about the kingdom, speech in which he gives us samples of how the lifestyle of a follower of Jesus is to differ from the scribes and Pharisees, etc. Well, let's look a little bit at Jesus' speeches and some typical features of his discourses. Jesus' speeches from a literary perspective can be characterized as aphoristic, poetic, patterned, subversive, and a fusion of genres as structured. Let's see. Aphoristic. By aphoristic, when we talk about somebody's speech, we mean that his speech has characteristics of aphorisms. We don't use that term much anymore, but brief And a term we do use very much today is sound bites. Jesus was the master of sound bites. Aphoristic statements are typically memorable. They're structured in some way that they're easy to remember, or they use wordplay of some sort to make them easy to remember. They are proverb-like because, in fact, proverbs are tend to be, if you look at the proverbs, say, in the Book of Proverbs, or if you look at the proverbs in Ben Franklin's almanac, they're brief, they're memorable, and they're usually giving you some wisdom of one sort. A couple of examples: do not judge, or you too will be judged, okay? You have some structure and wordplay there. Judged, active, passive, do not, or this will happen, etc. And then that would be unpacked by the context and such that, and leaving a little ambiguity as well, which is typical of aphoristic statements. Does this mean that if we're judgmental, people will tend to judge us? Well, yes, I think it does. Does this also mean that if we're judgmental, God is going to judge us? Yes, I think it does very much as well. One of the characteristics of speech in the Jewish circles at New Testament times was what we call the divine passive, in which a passive verb would be used without specifying who the actor is, but this is going to happen to you, and the actor is fairly clearly God. So don't be judgmental, or God will bring more judgment upon you. Don't be judgmental, or people will be more inclined to judge you harshly, etc. Another memorable sound bite of Jesus, if you like: if the blind lead the blind, both will fall into the ditch. Uses a picture that would be a little ludicrous, if you like, in real life: a blind man being led around by another blind man, but in fact implying that that is in fact what is going on at New Testament times, that the Pharisees particularly, and this characterized everybody as Pharisee, but typically could not see spiritual truth. They had not been regenerated. They didn't really know the Lord, some of them, and as a result, because they were leaders, because they were opinion makers, they were leading other people around who did not recognize spiritual truth. And just as in physical life, a blind person leading a blind person is probably going to wind up with a calamity coming upon both of them, falling into a ditch. So Jesus is warning that if people allow themselves to be led around by their blind spiritual leaders, they're going to fall into a spiritual ditch. Some disaster is going to happen to them. Not only were Jesus' words aphoristic, they're also poetic. Our poetry in English today is characterized typically by rhyme and meter. Not all of it rhymes, and not all of it is metric either, but typically characterized. But Jesus was not generally, because I think perhaps like the Hebrew poetry, it was set up so that it could be converted into another language rather well, and rhyme and meter don't carry very well. So Jesus often uses what the psalm writers did, Hebrew parallelism, in which two lines of his speech are parallel to one another in their meaning, and that will then carry when you translate. He used concrete images. We had already spoken of the narration being concrete, but Jesus' own speech is concrete as well, and that's characteristic of poetry, to speak about the mist coming in like little cat steps or something of that sort. My memory is not so great in that area. Though using concrete imagery of some sort, particularly metaphors and simile, in which you're comparing something, either telling the reader you're comparing it. These Pharisees are like whited tombs, like whitewashed tombs, would be a simile, and a metaphor would be to say the same thing without using the word as or like. Paradox, saying something that sounds contradictory, but in fact when you think about it, it really is not. It's something that catches your attention, if you like. A use of hyperbole, exaggeration for the purpose of effects. Jesus' opponents, here again at the Pharisees, are pictured as a diner drinking soup and straining out the gnats out of the soup, but swallowing the camels that have gotten into the soup. obviously a hyperbole, if you like, but intended to drive a point home. This is something that's used today very effectively by at least some political cartoonists, in which they exaggerate something to make it clear what their point is. So we get this example from Jesus of a hyperbole. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven. Camels can't go through the eye of a needle. And yet, instead of saying, just as it's impossible for a camel to go through the eye of a needle, so it's impossible for a rich man to enter heaven, that would be a non-hyperbolic version of the same statement, if you like. Here, hyperbolic saying, it's easier for this to happen than for that, etc. Well, there are ways of getting a camel through the eye of a needle, grinding up the camel very fine in a meat grinder of the right sort, and then ramming it through, etc., but not easy. The point, I think, is that rich people do not tend to depend upon God. They depend upon their riches. And one of the things you have to have to enter heaven is a dependence upon God, a recognition that you absolutely need Him. So that's the kind of point that this thing is making, but it's doing it briefly, in a few words. It's poetic, if you like that. It's aphoristic, if you like, okay? Rather than, as scholars have to do, unpacking and explaining and driving people to distraction with all of that. Jesus' speech is patterned, makes use of a lot of repetition, of balanced sentences and phrases, etc. Notice this one out of the Sermon on the Mount. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be open to you. We'll see what's going on with repetition. You've got ask and seek and knock and, okay? And then the typical result when you're asking for something, you want somebody to give you something. When you're seeking something, you want to find it. When you're knocking on the door, you want the door to be opened, etc. So you get a balance in each one of them. So you're using different verbs of seeking, perhaps, and corresponding verbs for the result, etc. And all of this driving home to you the importance of prayer, the importance of praying to the one who can give you, rather than to seek in the wrong ways for places where you will not find what you really need. Jesus' speech is often subversive. That term has a kind of a left-wing flavor to it, if you like, but it need not. The word means that which overturns, if you like, something. Jesus attacks our everyday way of thinking. Our everyday way of thinking is a type of thinking that's characterized by sin and by pride and by self-dependency and the wrong kind of independence and jealousy and all of these things. Jesus attacks our everyday way of thinking, but he doesn't do it by just saying, well, don't do that. So he doesn't do it by the sort of way that perhaps many of us who grew up in churches were familiar with being told by Sunday school teachers and parents and pastors and that. Jesus undermines our conventional values. So undermining is another, attacking and undermining are ways of thinking of subversive. Our conventional values. It's not that Jesus is in favor of robbing, cheating, stealing, nothing of the sort. He just wants us to see that average upstanding citizens are characterized by robbing, cheating, stealing. That's part of the point of his parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. Think about the Beatitudes in this regard. Picture of the meek inheriting the earth, or the humble inheriting the earth, whereas our conventional values are you've got to put yourself first, you've got to be self-assertive, all of that sort of thing. The Beatitudes, in fact, attack our conventional values, our everyday way of thinking, and they look totally, what should we say, unrealistic, irrational. Stop and think about it, though. That also characterizes Jesus' remark about loving your neighbor as you love yourself, doing to others as you would have them do to you. If you stop and think about it, you realize that if everybody did that, why, our society would be practically heaven on earth. But why don't people do that? Well, the simple theological answer is we're sinners. But if you unpack that, it's because we're afraid of what other people will do to us. They'll take advantage of us if we do that. And Jesus attacks that kind of way of thinking by reminding us that, in fact, God is in control of the universe. And short-term things may turn out very badly for us if we seek to do God's will, but in the long run it will not, because God does control the universe. Another feature of Jesus' speech is fusion of genres. Think for a moment of the Sermon on the Mount. We've got beatitudes there, of blessings. We've got character sketches there, the fellow who has the log of wood in his eye and is trying to do eye surgery on somebody else, etc. The fellow who's putting up a fast house without fooling with the foundation, etc. We've got proverbs in the Sermon on the Mount. We've got satire in the Sermon on the Mount. We've got lyrical things in the Sermon on the Mount. Beautiful passages. We've got parables. So we've got all of these different kind of genres that show up in the Sermon on the Mount. If we back up and ask, what is the genre of the sermon as a whole? Well, it's a sermon of some sort. Reichen would suggest it's also utopian literature. It's telling us of how things ought to be, what a perfect way of responding would be like. Okay, a utopia is drawn from a Greek word, actually two Greek words, ou, not, and topos, place, and means nowhere. And that was kind of the idea that the people developed in these stories of something that was too perfect, if you like. Well, many people have viewed the Sermon on the Mount as too perfect, but it really shows us that God is calling us to a astonishing lifestyle, and that it's not finally dangerous the way any other kind of lifestyle is, because the God who is just and who cannot lie and who will do what is right is the God who really exists. Sermon also is what we might call an inaugural address. Jesus is setting up what is to characterize his kingdom, just as an inaugural address of a recently elected president would suggest what they plan to do in the course of their term. It's wisdom literature. It's telling you how you ought to behave, if you like, just as the Proverbs do. Well, Jesus' words are structured. They're simple. They're highly artistic. Makes use of single themes for a whole section, or threefold examples. Reichen, in his book Words of Life, page 120, characterizes Jesus' speech this way. The artistry of the design is apparent. There's no reason why the sermon as it stands could not be exactly the form Jesus' longer sermons took. This struck me some years ago, I think before I ever read this in Reichen, when I thought of how liberal scholars often are trying to divide up the Sermon on the Mount into this piece and that piece, and Matthew, or whoever really wrote the Gospel of Matthew, is alleged to have assembled these pieces, etc. And yet, to me, the artistry of the design was striking, and it suggested to me that a poetic genius and a ethical genius has put this material together. And I don't think that's Matthew. I think it's Jesus. There's no reason why the sermon as it stands could not be exactly the form Jesus' longer sermons took. Well, that's the end of our discussion of the Gospels and its literature. And I suggest for you that in the future you seek to be on the lookout for these features, because they'll help you to appreciate what's going on, and they may help you to see things that are really there that you hadn't seen before, that will make the Gospels even more gripping to you, even more powerful to you. May it be so.